Sunday, thank you for being here today for our seventh show. Welcome to Restoring Our Roots podcast, the voice of the decriminalized nature movement. This podcast is a gathering space where we explore the wisdom of entheogenic plants and fungi, the beauty of natural healing, and the importance of reconnecting with the sacred earth. Every month, we'll hear from visionaries, healers, and advocates who are working with entheogenic plants and fungi and returning us to a balanced relationship with nature. My name is Larry Norris. I'm the co-founder of Decriminalized Nature and a national organizing director. I've been lucky enough to help a lot of people over the last 6 years with giving them the tools they need to support passing policy in their local area. So if you are interested in passing some policy to decriminalize or deprioritize and defund entheogenic plants and fungi, please give us a contact at decriminalizednature.org. We have a pretty new website that just came up, has a lot of great stuff on it. So check that out. I'm really excited for you to be here. I would also like to introduce our behind the scenes friend, Rachel, the Tinkerbell in the ear, so to speak, to bring the sparkle, who's been really instrumental in bringing this project to life. So thank you, Rachel, for all your efforts and for continuing to inspire the Decriminalized Nature podcast series. Rachel is doing a lot of work behind the scenes as well and posting these episodes on Spotify and other platforms the week following the live show. So you'll see this show come out next Sunday. Our guest today, we're really excited, is Ron McNutt. He is a member and organizer of the Psychedelic Bar Association, which is a collective of attorneys looking to support individuals working with entheogenic plants and fungi, whether policy, religious use, or even case support. I was really excited when I spoke with Ron the first time. He had really so much knowledge of the psychedelic history and law and other nuances in the field. I really wanted to bring him on and have this dialogue to share with the larger podcast audience. So just a little heads up before we begin, for any of those watching this show live, please, if you have any questions or comments, go ahead and put those in the chat box. Rachel will be collecting those, and about 10 minutes before the show is over, we'll be answering those or offering some comments as well back. So thank you for participating as well. This is a co-creative collaboration with all the community as well. So thank you for being here today, Ron. How are you today?
I'm doing really well. It's a beautiful day in Nashville, and I'm glad to be with you. I appreciate very much the work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's we'd love to get into Nashville as well. I know that that'll be coming for too long. Maybe we can start off for the audience here, give a little background bio, maybe tell us about who you are and how you got interested in this area of expertise.
Well, I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, and I went to Tufts University. And when I was in Newton, I didn't know it at the time, but the Harvard Psilocybin Project was active there. It was in the 1960s. Of course, I didn't know it. I was a little boy. And then in Massachusetts, there was a lot of activity around psychedelics. And I graduated from high school in 1974. And after high school, I had experience with psychedelics. And I actually took a wonderful course in college and made friends with the professor. It was called Altered States of Consciousness. And by that time, I'd had experiences where I felt that I was part of nature, with LSD. And but I had a particularly profound experience in Austin, Texas, on the bicentennial. And I felt like I was told that I had a place with God. And so it gave me a sense of responsibility. I did go to law school. I had a 40-year law career. And now I'm working as a chaplain. I retired, didn't know what I wanted to do, but sometimes you get inspired that way. But I do donate my time as a journalist and help support the Nashville Psychedelic Society. And I am one of the stewards of the Litigation and Advocacy Committee of the Psychedelic Bar Association. And I thank you for coming and speaking to us in January.
Yeah, that was really great. I enjoyed that conversation as well. You know, we hear a lot from folks how a big part of this work, and we even use the word entheogen, and obviously you're familiar with SoulQuest and other places as well, but you spoke a little bit about that experience in Austin, Texas, where you found this connection to the divine, if you will, or to God. Maybe What was that like for you? Did you have that experience before? Was it something totally new? Was it like a paradigm shattering moment? I know there's some people, I think about this that when I studied my undergrad, I was very much neurosciencey, right? And then the first types of experiences where I realized how big everything was really like mind blowing for me. Like, what take us through that experience for you in terms of.
So I think that one of the terms that I got from Dennis McKenna and the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss is the word phenomenology. It's one of those words that you hear and your eyes glaze over, but basically it says that your own experience is what's most important to you. So my experience on that particular day was ushered in with sense of delight and enjoyment, but immediately preceded by absolute terror, because I thought that I was going to die. I was in a situation where it was a celebratory environment. We were on the streets of Austin, Texas, me and a friend of mine, and someone called the police for whatever reason. I was only 19, and the police weren't really interested in doing anything about it, and they just talked to us and went away. But it started a whole process of, like the worst case scenario that, oh, I was going to be arrested. Oh, I was going to embarrass my family. I was going to be a failure. And so all of the things that Jung refers to as your shadow come up. And what we present to the world is our persona, and what we try to suppress is our shadow. And I had a lot of fear and grief and the things that I didn't want to face. But when I surrendered, in other words, when I gave up because I didn't feel like I could fight it anymore, I just found that it wasn't so much a dual reality where I and the deity were like facing each other. It was more like everything was in a full and complete unitary space and time that was, beyond the present, but deeper than ordinary time. And so I felt that I was loved, and I felt that my fears subsided, and it gave me a sense of faith for what comes after this life. Because I had a tremendous amount of fear. I still do have a lot of fear about death, but I think that these entheogens can help us see beyond them. That being said, I've had a lot of profound experiences since then. With psychedelics and without psychedelics, but nothing like that one. However, I do feel like I made progress personally beyond where I was at that time. I wasn't really completely individuated and capable person. Not that I am now, but it gave me a real benchmark and a sense of belonging that has been with me for my whole life.
Yeah, imagine like that first time when I think that first one is probably the most powerful because it's like you have nothing to compare it to, right? That first big experience like that. When you speak about that, also it seems like when you spoke about that class, Altered States of Consciousness, it seems like there is this thing, whether it's this connection to it almost sounds like you were talking about a mystical experience. It was beyond space and time, as they define it, right? It was so this unitive experience. It sounded like it was fearful at first, but positive and blissful. Which I want to talk a little bit about that fear as well, and then in the future in terms of just even like legal issues and how that can really influence your experience. But you had this class on altered states of consciousness. For me, that was really profound. When I was doing my studies, looking at what is consciousness, what are these places beyond? Tell us a little bit about it. I forgot who the person was that wrote the book Altered States of Consciousness. Who was that person?
Charles Tartt.
Charles Tartt. That's right, Charles Tartt. Yeah,
And
exactly.
that was the book that Paul Stamets had loaned to his friend that the friend's father found and burned.
Right. So, but it seems like a lot of people that are doing this work always. at least when I started coming out, it's changed a little bit. We're housing under, like, well, we can talk about consciousness or altered states of consciousness, but if we talk about drugs or psychedelics or entheogens, maybe that's a little bit more taboo. So talk about, kind of what you learned in that class in terms of helping you examine this future area that you were looking into.
So that the TARC book was one of the textbooks, but there's also a book by Humphrey Osmond and Bernard Aronson called Psychedelics, which you can still get. It had a lot of articles. We had some speakers come to the class. One was Walter Houston Clark. He was an emeritus divinity school professor at Andover Newton. And he was a real strong believer in the religious potential for psychedelics. And another speaker who came to our class was Harvey Cox, who was a Harvard Divinity School professor. And he had had an experience partaking of peyote with the Huichol or the Wiratica of Mexico. And we also had Ram Dass, who was a Tufts graduate, and he was the Harvard professor who was helping to run the Harvard Psilocybin Project with Timothy Leary, and he had a conversion experience and became Ram Dass. He was a follower of Neem Karoli Baba and a very influential person in the psychedelic scene. But it was really important for me to take psychedelics seriously, because when you have a goal to use them as ways to connect with the spirit world, you're more likely to have a beneficial experience or to interpret the experience that you have in a way that helps you really integrate. I know you're interested in integration. That's something that we try to do is apply the lessons. Sometimes it seems like the lessons are so enormous that we're just bringing back a few grains of sand from an enormous beach, or a
Right.
few drops of water from an enormous fountain. But how you apply it, Houston Smith talked about how he's more interested in altered traits than altered states. And that, I think that that was one of the challenges that we've had, because our society was such an uncomfortable fit for people who'd had profound experiences where they realized the importance of connecting with others and being part of something that was great. We have something of our society is so focused on competition and distinguishing oneself and materialism that we have a lot of mental health problems from that, and trauma via the violence of our society. It can be a really uncomfortable fit. And so part of the benefit that I feel from my experience that psychedelics can provide is helping people feel more inclined to be of service and to encourage other people rather than to try to exploit and dominate other people. But that being said, it doesn't affect everybody the same way. And how we as a society provide access to these is going to be the most important challenge that we have in this field.
Absolutely, I agree. There's, and we'll touch on that in a minute in terms of some of the different styles. But since we're on the topic and pretty close to it, for folks that don't really know too much about the history there, could you talk a little bit more about maybe the Harvard Psilocybin Project? And it seems like you were really in that era of time when there's a lot of things going on, and this had, I don't know, was still kind of like figuring its way out through community, and people were exploring it in all these different ways and in ways that were really kind of brand new to the cultural sort of mindset or the ethos at the time. Talk about a little bit about the Harvard Psilocybin Project and also kind of what you thought and what you saw in the sort of the 60s and 70s as this was sort of emerging.
Well, it was a very exciting time. The women's liberation movement, the civil rights movement, sensitivity toward people with different sexual orientations and expressions. And I think that it was partly connected. So Mescaline had been discovered in the late 1800s, and peyote was part of the Native American Church of North America as it spread north from Mexico. But the psychedelics themselves had been pretty much suppressed by the colonial powers. I mean, when Columbus landed in Hispaniola, the indigenous people were using yopo, which they called cahoba. And so they were encephalating something that had dimethyltryptamine in it. And those trees are still part of some indigenous practices. And they encountered peyote. They couldn't suppress peyote use, but they tried and they persecuted it. And then the psilocybin use among the Aztec and other Mexican Indians had been so effectively suppressed by the Spanish and other colonial powers that basically it had been all but forgotten about, and only a couple of scholarly papers in the West mentioned it, but it survived in the mountains of Mexico. There was a very important Life magazine article that came out in, I believe it was 1957. Gordon Wasson, who was an investment banker, had had an experience. He and his wife had had an experience with psilocybin. They were the first European descended people to be allowed to partake in that ceremony, which was called Velada. Wasson had actually participated in one before by a man named Don Aurelio Carreras, but Don Aurelio ate mushrooms himself and smoked a cigar, and he read their minds and told them what was going on with their son, which was pretty amazing. But psychedelics had become widespread in psychotherapy. There was a lot of LSD therapy, particularly in Southern California. And there was a lot of research, a lot of papers. And in fact, some of the research was sponsored by the CIA. There was a project called MK Ultra. And a lot of professors were actually having their research sponsored by it. And some of it was just highly unethical. But interestingly, people like Ken Kesey were paid to. Ken Kesey wrote Sometimes a Great Notion and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and some other works. He started the acid tests and had the idea for the bus. Well, anyway, he got the idea of this liberation of the mind from of a government-funded test when he was working at a mental hospital. So, but all of this had come to a screeching halt with the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, and all the research ended. And so when I entered college and was taking this Altered States of Consciousness class in 1976, pretty much all of the research had ended, and they put the psychedelics on Schedule One, and people were getting very long sentences. And it was part of the culture wars that the Nixon administration and the Reagan administration were using to sort of, people have a tendency to scapegoat others and to look down on people who have different ideas because it makes them feel insecure. And there was a lot of threat to a mindset which was sort of fundamentalist and rigid and hierarchical and male dominated. And unfortunately, I think psychedelics were scapegoated, and people had to kind of hide. And it was a shame.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think a lot about, even just sort of the influence of the CIA even around the M, or excuse me, with the Mezatec mushrooms. I think there is somebody I was reading at the University of Delaware. There is still a scholarship that's given out to one of the chemists there that took the mushrooms and gave it to the CIA. And it's like, wait, you stole these mushrooms from Rhea Sabina to give to the CIA. How is there still a scholarship at the university for that? I was kind of, this was like maybe like 4 or 5 years ago, but I was surprised to see that they're still celebrating that instead of like, especially because all of the trauma and the challenges that came to the Sabina family after this kind of came above ground.
Yeah, I have. Oh, so Walter Clark introduced me to Salvador Roquette, and I went to Salvador Roquette's convivials and worked with some people who supported him. Salvador Roquette, he worked with Maria Sabina. He had a clinic in Mexico City that was busted, and he would send people down to have sessions with Maria Sabina and other curanderos. And so my understanding is a lot of hippies showed up in Huautla de Jimenez, and there were a lot of adverse repercussions. It was sad that some of it was resentment. That being said, she was respected by the members of her community. She had a good relationship with the priest. She was a devout Catholic, and she did continue to provide veladas for visitors. And one of my friends visited, and there was a film crew that came, and the men of her community created a barrier so that she couldn't be exploited that way. And the Mexican government did send her to Mexico City to view a film that honored her legacy. And when she lost, she said that she lost some of her powers, but she was also getting older, and sometimes people lose some of their powers. But I want to tell you that, so when Richard Evans Schultes was down in central Mexico, and he had found out about the mushrooms. And when Wasson went down one time, the CIA sent someone with him to, because they wanted to try to patent the psilocybin. But Wasson also brought down a French naturalist, a mycologist, who he was the director of the French National the Biological Museum. His name is Roger Haim, or Roger Aim. He was a watercolor aficionado. He painted and identified new mushrooms. But anyway, so he gave some of the mushrooms, he propagated them and learned how to grow them. And he sent some to Albert Hofmann, who had synthesized LSD. Albert Hofmann was a plant chemist. And when Albert Hofmann synthesized them, I'm sorry, he isolated psilocybin and psilocin, and he got the trademark. He got the patent on it before the CIA, so he beat the CIA. And psilocybin now has the formula. The USONA Institute has put a really good formula that's easy to use. David Nichols had a graduate student who helped him, I believe. Anyway, it's public domain now. And but then this so it's a really remarkable thing that Hoffman beat the CIA, and then he went back to Huautla de Jimenez and shared these pills with Maria Sabina, and she said that they had the same spirit as the mushrooms that they couldn't get during the dry season. And then he found some of the morning glories. The sacred morning glories, Ololioki, and he found out that the seeds had lysergic acid. So it's called a virtuous circle. It went from getting ergot fungus, and then finding psilocybin, and then discovering a full circle that there we have it. The sacred morning glories also have lysergic acid in them. Well, Albert Hofmann helped co find out that they may have been using something very much like this in the Eleusinian mysteries. So in the old world, doesn't seem to have much of a history of use of psychedelics. They did have a lot of persecution of nature worshipers they referred to as witches, who would use the scopolamine and atropine substances, but they're inferior psychedelics. But Hoffman and Wasson and Karl Rook, the classics professor, wrote a wonderful book called The Road to Eleusis that theorizes that the ancient Greeks for 1,000 years had a very vivid visionary experience that was sacramental, and it was held by women. The women were leaders of this, and Brian Mărărescu has theorized that the early Christian church was influenced by the writings from the Dionysian tradition, and that the wedding at Cana was like right out of the story of Dionysus. And Jesus lived right near a temple to Dionysus. So the idea of a sort of a democratic visionary experience is a distinct possibility. But these are challenging experiences, as you know. And what happened to Soma and what happened to Eleusis? Eleusis was suppressed by some of the later Christian traditions, which is really unfortunate. You know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could still go to Eleusis, which is a walking distance from Athens, Greece, and have a visionary experience that would make us feel more a part of our society and culture, rather than having to secret these psychedelic substances and find out that we don't really feel at home necessarily in our society.
Yeah, there's something you brought up there, that I've always been a little curious about. And obviously, part of what we do with decriminalized nature is to really talk about how these are plants and mushrooms that grow out of the ground. These are connected to the earth. You know, asks a bigger question of like, why are these even here to have these big experiences? And obviously, there's going to be a little bit of a rift, which you have like the CIAs or the Compass Pathways or the other places that are trying to patent it. Because once you extract it and you create it, then now it becomes patentable. Now it's sort of taken away. The essence, a lot of people say, but I know I hear a lot of people reference the Maria Sabina quote, which says basically like, oh, you know, Hoffman brought it back, and she says, oh, this is the same spirit. What are your thoughts around? Because I always think, well, you know, would she have thought that if she did this in Sandoz laboratory? Like, what is the set and set, the potential of set and setting for her to have really just opened up the doorway to something that she's been working with, and so she felt that spirit because she was in the place that she's always been engaging with it. Because you think about like, well, I mean, the extraction, I think he called it Indocybin, right? Was the name from Sandoz, the
That sounds right. I'm not sure.
and
I
obviously there's
know
other components.
LSD was Delicid. Delicid.
Okay, right on. Yeah. So, but yet in the mushroom we know now, there's psilocybin, there's psilocin, there's baocystine, there's norbaocystine, there's beta carbolines, there's the spirit of the mushroom, if we want to go into that sort of larger category of thought. What are your thoughts around sort of the set and setting in regards to that sort of quote? You know, because I only really hear synthetic or pharmaceutical people say that oftentimes. And so I wonder if there's some extra things that we're not thinking about or sort of confounding variables that might have caused that response.
Well, I think that it's just incredibly mysterious. And like here's another example. We heard about the virtuous circle of Albert Hofmann and beating the CIA, and the irony of the CIA introducing Ken Kesey to LSD. So there were these two brothers, and they're friends with your mentor, or yeah, they were friends with your mentor, Luis Eduardo Luna. So the McKenna brothers went down to La Charrera because they had this idea that they were going to be able to penetrate beyond the dimension of time using an early active dimethyltryptamine. With a certain resonance sound. And so they wanted to learn about this from the Witoto. And they went down to La Charrera and they met Luis Eduardo Luna, and they had psilocybin mushroom experience. And when they were down there, things went awry. But they did find a lot of psilocybin, and they found some ayahuasca vine. And Dennis McKenna had a very, very intense 10-day experience. They didn't know if he was going to be okay, but he is fine. But the long and short of it is, they brought the technology back to learn how to teach people how to grow psilocybin mushrooms. So that to me seems rather miraculous. And it almost looks like the divine trickster. And I know it was a very difficult ordeal for the McKenna brothers, but it looks kind of like these two kind of goofy guys went down with a wild idea and they brought back the technology that, for a long time, there weren't a lot of psychedelic substances around that you could find, except mushrooms. And then the idea, there's a wonderful movie called Boyhood, which I think is a great depiction of, the potential for the way that people use mushrooms. And what Dennis McKenna said is that you couldn't be too squirrely and grow mushrooms, because it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. So you have to care. You have to put yourself into it. And so if you devote and you give something, then you might get this wonderful reward. And the reward was that a lot of people learned that these psychedelics are not as dangerous as they may have been told. And in fact, there's wonderful potential. And I think another interesting synchronicity is in 2006, there was a Supreme Court opinion that kind of fishtailed on a previous opinion, and it said that Unión de Vegetal, ayahuasca religion, had the right to practice when it had a very good, safe container that it had set up. But that was also the year that there was this wonderful research out of Johns Hopkins with psilocybin that Bob Jesse and Bill Richards and Roland Griffiths were involved in, and it showed
Healthy normals.
that yeah, with that people could have genuine religious experiences with psilocybin. And so to me, that's kind of like the linchpin. It's things started going over to the other way of looking at it. And then a lot of people who, elite special forces and military people, so much of our society is subject to the effects of deep trauma and also head injuries. And these substances, particularly the tryptamines like ayahuasca and psilocybin, are very helpful with dealing with the trauma and the head injuries. So elite special forces and military, and a lot of women who were victims of sexual abuse and other forms of abuse as children, have benefited from these substances. So it seems like now, out of compassion, and the whole argument that if the creator made these substances, there must be some reason for it and some proper way to use it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think that for me that 2006 study, while it's good, we're seeing all the mental health work that's going on. I think there's also potentially a that can make it difficult because now you're dealing with a higher level of sort of challenge and acute issues that are already existing and really needing to hold that container in a different kind of way. But I think what was unique about that 2006 study was it was really tapping into this idea of this healthy normals, which is like, well, can it also benefit people that aren't sick or have that.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's the Bob Jesse's term,
Right, yeah,
the
exactly.
betterment
Of well
of
people.
well people.
Right, yeah. So that's great. So there's that dynamic that's playing out now, and we see that kind of the back and forth with sort of the clinical studies and the decriminalization. It feels like there was a similar dynamic or sort of duality in sort of this Ken Kesey era too, where you have Ken Kesey, which was much more, I don't know, I'll let you explain it, but maybe more, grassrootsy, more sort of extreme. And then you have sort of the Leary, which was kind of, despite what a lot of people, think of Leary, was much more kind of buttoned up and more kind of, meditate and, do this kind of, can you speak to the sort of the West Coast, East Coast dynamic of this? And then in that sort of maybe also speak to the way the indigenous approaches are being sort of talked about in that sort of same sort of cultural era there.
Sure. I'll let you know the little bit that I know. I have not actually had a psychedelic experience in an indigenous setting. So in Peru, there are a number of ayahuasca retreat centers, and there was a large number of indigenous groups that participated with ayahuasca in South America. And some of these traditions inspired syncretic traditions like Santo Daime and União do Vegetal, which incorporate elements of African spiritism and Christianity and the indigenous traditions, but they're in a sort of like a church setting, and they have shown themselves to be beneficial in studies in Brazil, and that helped inspire, I think, the UDV, União do Vegetal case in the United States. But the indigenous traditions are group traditions, and that's the most common context that you have. There's a wonderful Colombian anthropologist or archaeologist named Gerardo Reichel Dolmetoff, and he lived with some Desana people, the Tucanawan, and they believed that we're all connected, and it's a beautiful theory called animism as a theology, that everything is alive and that we're part of something greater and deeper. And if you study it, it's a lot like quantum theory. And if you look at a Huichol yarn painting, you'll see that everything seems to be connected. And it's kind of like a psychedelic experience where you just feel like, like the space between me and the plant may not really be empty at all. And the everything around me may not be dead, and my connection with the spirit may not be through some hierarchical organization. It may be more direct. So these ideas they can present some challenges to some established traditions, but they can also revivify or revive some of the sort of like dried up the sort of sense of isolation and the fear-provoking lack of connection that people seem to feel. But when psychedelics came on the scene and they sort of like went out of the clinic, yes, Leary gets penned for that because they started giving it to people sort of like in a in sort of like an imaginative way, to try to promote creativity. And they were giving it to, people who are like poets or artists or and then some people would use it for problem solving. They say that Francis Crick helped figure out the double helix model for the DNA with being inspired with LSD. But then the idea originally was, oh, they just found this neurotransmitter called serotonin, and it looks very much like DMT or psilocybin. Psilocybin is a tryptamine. But so the idea was, oh, there's a neurotransmitter and there's this other substance that looks like it, and maybe that's what makes people crazy. So they decided that they were going to try to see if people went crazy with it. But then you had really inspired people like Al Hubbard, who developed the whole idea of set and setting and the comfortable setting to have this with the headphones and the eye shades. And some people think, well, you shouldn't do it that way. You should do it in a communal setting. But the idea seems to be pretty well universal, that it's a good idea to have someone with some experience near you, because there are dangers, there are risks, and people can get grandiose, or people can get hyper terrified. So originally the clinical setting was there would be a clinician there watching you, and but you thought that you were supposed to be going crazy. Well, how helpful is that? But then people like Hubbard said, "This is the most amazing thing in my life. I want to share this with the world." And so he gathered up a lot of LSD and a lot of, I think, psilocybin, and he went around and he was like giving it to people. They called him the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. But the idea of the acid tests was it spawned the Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead used to play at shows, and light shows were developed by Owsley Stanley. I mean, perfected in a sense, and sound. Owsley Stanley not only helped the Grateful Dead with their careers and their sound, but he also was making LSD. And for a long time, LSD wasn't even illegal. So people were experimenting with it and not being entirely careful. And like, if you read about the trip that Kesey took, somebody kind of went off the deep end and didn't complete the trip. And I shouldn't be laughing because it's serious business, and one of the people the CIA experimented with it, he took his own life. But a lot of people who are who are so desperate to end their lives, they've gotten into such a terrible rut of self-loathing and unsatisfactoriness that psychedelics can help those people. So, you have people who are, normal, who might, have ended up really depressed. Maybe if I hadn't taken psychedelics, I just would have been depressed, because law career is drudgery, and you're fighting with people all the time, and you don't necessarily feel connected. I think it has a, and that's what the kind of thing that Paul Stamets talks about, and the way that Desana that Reichel Dolmetov talked about, they thought that it helped them connect to the Milky Way or sacred places where two rivers converged. And they used the Yahe, which is their word for their ayahuasca brew, to communicate. And the master of the plants and the master of the animals, they say, oh, it's okay to take this plant or this animal, but we don't want to burden the whole scene. Well, my ancestors, our ancestors, the European ancestors, they just would just kill like, tens of thousands of buffalo just for, like for fun. I mean, what an awful society to do something like that. And so, we're hoping that some of the wisdom of the ancients will rub off on us, or maybe we're spiritually connected in ways that we don't understand. But I remember, and I don't know what happened to this myth, but when I was doing my altered states of consciousness class, we were told that like the spirit of the peyote was that there was a prophecy that the spirit of the peyote was going to turn the hearts and minds of the descendants of these white people who seemed to have no reverence for nature, and would bring them to a more sustainable, sharing, generous philosophy. Which actually, if you think about it, is at the very basis of all of the major religions. So, people like Walter Houston Clark, they were really excited about what psychedelics could do for religion. And, and Hunt Priest, and he's a Episcopal priest. He started Ligare when he took he was involved in one of the studies that they did at Johns Hopkins with religious professionals, and it turned his life around. He'd never had psychedelics before, and he was kind of at a dry phase in his career, and it brought him to life. And so there are tens of thousands of people like that, and our hope is that this time around there won't be all this. A lot of the same mistakes that were made in the past. And so that's my hope, is that decriminalization efforts will pave the way, along with the wisdom from the people who've been devoted to trying to create risk reduction practices.
Yeah, absolutely. I always like to say to till the soil. So we're not paving over the nature, right? But yeah, this is I think this is really something special that we've been seeing all across the US in regards to changing this policy, because having it be criminalized with no science behind why it's criminalized, to really trying to stifle a way of thought, which is animistic and appreciative and respectful, or at its base core ideas, that's what a lot of people talk about when they come back from these experiences. So yeah, I really hope that that will continue to move forward and not get sort of we're seeing as like Oregon and this new bill that came out of Washington, a couple other places where it gets stuck in the system where now, there's got to be all these regulations on it to protect the fear, to protect from the fear, but then it's like so expensive that nobody can even do this anyway. So again, by hopefully at least removing those criminal penalties, we can start to build that culture, rebuild that culture in a way that works, having learned the lessons. That's one thing I think that's different about this time frame than sort of the 60s and 70s era, is there was nothing really to compare it to. Now we have sort of that history to kind of look at and say, okay, here's how to do this in a different way. Here's things that worked or that didn't work, or challenges that might come up and that sort of thing. So yeah, really looking forward to how this sort of keep moving forward in terms of policy. I know we're getting kind of tight on time. I know that we could talk about history, and I think we'll have you back on to talk about history of psychedelics and entheogens and plants and all that kind of stuff, because I think you could have 4 or 5 episodes at least, just kind of digging into all the different people. And I think there's a lot of even organizations and people that you mentioned that I'm sure there'd be an audience that would like to unpack that a little bit more. But before we get too far into this, let's talk a little bit about, I know you're part of the Psychedelic Bar Association. Let's chat a little bit about that. Maybe just tell everyone kind of what that's about and what the ideas are behind that, and how to contact you for that if they're interested in working with y'all.
Well, I did want to put in a little plug for Oregon and Colorado. So Colorado has a decriminalization program that's is very exciting, and we're going to see what happens with that. And I think for a lot of people, a couple $1,000 or maybe even $1,000 for a psilocybin experience in a regulated setting might be certainly well worth it. I would say if the Psychedelic Bar Association, we've been beating the bushes because there's clinical therapeutic, and there was all that hope about, the MAPS-Lykos initiative with MDMA, and looks like there's a setback with that, and that's going to hold back clinical setting with psilocybin. And then there's the ceremonial or group psychedelic access. And there is a long tradition of protecting the free exercise of religion. And so if it looks like a religion, like a set of beliefs, a congregation, that kind of thing, that's something that the law may recognize, and it may expand also. So we're looking with the Psychedelic Bar Association. We've just been trying to figure out where things are going, and maybe now it's time to come up with a strategy. And so we've been inviting speakers to come, and we're also trying to embolden and support our members, because as I said, law is a challenging profession. So right now we're kind of looking at the different approaches to access, and I'm really excited about it, that there's a chance I may become more deeply involved with Psychedelic Bar Association. But right now I'm just running a committee and providing information to people. And I'm also available on the Nashville Psychedelic Society Facebook site.
Great, wonderful. And then we kind of look at, so you mentioned a little bit about kind of some of the areas that are kind of opening up and maybe other attorneys. If somebody is has some challenges, legal challenges, whatever else, is this a place that people can contact the Psychedelic Bar Association? Will they be able to find people that can help give advice or support or that type of thing?
Yes, yeah, that's there are specialists. Usually, you're going to want someone, if you're in trouble, you're going to want someone who's licensed in your state, because different states have different sets of laws. But then there are people who do transactional work who help like organizations set up entheogenic churches. I know Allison Hoots and the Sacred Plant Alliance are very helpful in that, and there are other practitioners who can help with that too. But the grassroots work is it's all being done by creatives, young people, a lot of young people, and some older people, but mostly younger people with a lot more energy. Are getting a lot of traction lo with local initiatives, and that's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's been fun to watch that, and I think at least from our perspective and with Decrim Nature, I would say this: it's we're teaching people how to decriminalize or deprioritize and defund entheogenic plants and fungi policy, but also it's like we're training people to just learn how to make change happen. I think so many people forget the government works for us. Right? We forget that there are people out there that give all our authority over to them to make the decisions, but if we don't go in there and actually make a good argument for why these shouldn't be criminalized, why we should be able to engage in our own healing practices, why we should be able to grow mushrooms out of the ground or other plants that grow out of the ground that shouldn't be something that I think there's a, the Bill Hicks that said who has the authority to criminalize nature. I'm paraphrasing, but it grows out of the ground. It's like saying God is wrong or something like that, right? So really being able to bring this into the community, I think, has been really great. And then teaching people how to make all different types of change, I think, has been really wonderful, because I think these will be tools that we can all use in the future as there's a lot of transformation and transitions that are happening in the world.
Yeah, and I do think that I think that there's been a lot of sort of not enlightenment, but I think that people have recognized with the cannabis decriminalization that it may not be the end of the world after all. And then there are special locations, like I know you can get what are called truffles that are psychedelic in the Netherlands at the smart shops, and then there are also dispensaries in Jamaica. Jamaica has a very enlightened policy towards psilocybin. And in fact, when I went to Jamaica for my honeymoon in 1979, there was a restaurant, Miss Brown's, and I think there was a place called Ted's too, where you could just drink mushroom tea. And they'd say, "Oh, you should only have one. You should only have one." I said, "No. I'll take another one. It's my honeymoon." But since then, Amanda Fielding from the Beckley Foundation has been part of their process, and that's Jamaica is a really exciting place, because you talk about decolonializing. There were There were enslaved people who broke away and went into the jungles and the mountains of Jamaica, the Maroons, and they influenced the Rastafarian traditions. And Rastafarian traditions, they also had, I believe, there was psilocybin in Jamaica in 1979. There's psilocybin in Jamaica now. And I believe it's for sale from what I've read in the. I read a lot of articles about it, but there is psilocybin for sale in Jamaica at dispensaries.
And
So
this
it's
something that
not.
was
Well,
is
go ahead.
in Jamaica, were mushrooms naturally occurring, or did somebody bring those over, or those? I mean, I know mushrooms pretty much exist almost everywhere on the planet, but was this
Yeah,
something?
they don't even know where the first. So when I was a kid, they called psilocybe cubensis Stropharia cubensis, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that it might have been found, identified by, of course, the Aztec were using it. And so that was, it's in Mexico, and it was also in Jamaica. And I don't think it was introduced there. Now, the yopo trees may have been introduced there. The yopo has the DMT in it. But it's this, and this is a point that Schultes made, the ethnobotanist from Harvard. The New World just has a tremendous wealth of psychedelics. And why that is anybody's guess. But what I wanted to say about the whole idea of making something from nature illegal is two things. There's a wonderful book by Charles Grubb and Jim Grigsby called The Handbook of Medical Hallucinogens. Chapter two is by Dennis McKenna, and it's an impassioned argument about how you shouldn't make something illegal that God has made. And it just seems like a totally natural argument that we should be that way.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, thank you. So I know I really appreciate you being here. I know Rachel has a question and some comments as well. Maybe Rachel, do you want to jump in and we can answer those?
Oh, yes. All right. Wonderful conversation. I had a lot of really kind comments in the chat just saying that you're very knowledgeable, Ron, and just I guess all like the mythology behind the psychedelic movement has just been something that's been interesting. People just have been saying like great conversation, and I got people following us on various platforms. So thank you for that, Ron. But my question is bringing it back to I really love how you used technology to describe the gift of the mushrooms in terms of the McKenna brothers bringing that back to the world. So, in terms of technology, I wanted to get your take on legal language versus, let's say, more like poetic language when we're speaking about things. And how does that work when you're making a legal argument and you're talking about a mystical place? Thoughts.
Well, so if you make legal arguments, you're using them in different contexts. So in the religious or ceremonial context, the law doesn't really necessarily, it's not supposed to look at whether it's a valid belief or not. Unfortunately, so much of religion is associated with belief, and it should be more about having more alive, greater aliveness, being fully alive in this moment and in time. The other context would be to argue for, say, decriminalization. What you're doing there is you're saying, well, the benefits outweigh the harms. There are going to be harms. Well, there are harms associated with driving or flying. We as a society believe that the benefits outweigh the harms. So the benefit is my personal liberty, which is a due process right. You have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and it can be deprived by government interests of the highest order. And if it's a fundamental right, if it's just an average right, like maybe your right to privacy might be a fundamental right, your right to freedom of religion is a fundamental right. So the burden has to be justified very high. But the argument that I would make for decriminalization is there are spiritual interests of the highest order, but there's also a personal liberty interest. And the state has to justify intrusions on that liberty with showing that of at least a substantial basis. And if society and our elected officials decides that the benefits outweigh the risks, you don't necessarily have to argue it anymore because they've already made that decision, and that's happened in some locations. That being said, you have a duty of ordinary care. If I give mushrooms to a child and the child gets in trouble, then I'm liable because I caused this harm. But if I have a regulated system and something goes wrong and everybody follows those standards, the jury might decide that someone, just exercised ordinary care and it was something that couldn't be avoided. Juries don't tend to do that, but juries also don't give money to people they don't like. It's a really, really murky area, but we have to use our best conscience and our intentions and wisdom to try to make a safe container so that people will get the benefits and not be harmed.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you, Ron. Appreciate it. So we have a few more minutes, Ron. I don't know if there's anything else you want to sort of tie a knot on. I know we talked about a lot of things. Like I said, we could have quite a few more conversations on all this and
Yeah,
more folks. Is
there's
there anything else you'd like to touch on?
a couple things. One is that because this area of inquiry was so completely and effectively stultified, we haven't had the opportunity to develop the kind of information as a society that would be most beneficial. So if we had only been allowed to move forward from the 1970s, then we would have a lot greater advantage. We'd have a lot more interest. The other thing I wanted to say is there's this idea that came from a theologian in the early 1900s named Josiah Royce, the idea of the beloved community. And you may have heard John Lewis talking about it, but the idea is that we can all live together, and as a society, a diverse society is a good society. And I think that people who have experience with psychedelics, they can see that, and hopefully not see things through a lens of fear and domination. And my hope is that we can also learn that we need to look at things from a sustainability perspective, out of great love for nature, and learn to be living more simple lifestyles. I really think that it's not just making people better at performing so that they can be effective and successful in the terms of a materialistic society. But I do think that these are agents of spirituality that can help us be more inclined toward the fundamental values that will create a more resilient and sustainable society.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ron. What a way to wrap it up. I really appreciate it. Rachel, do you have anything else you want to say there?
That was really, really good. It was like a final thought, mic drop. Wonderful, Ron. Perfect.
Well,
Yes,
I
thank
feel
you.
like I I feel like I walked everyone through a mycelial network of rabbit holes. And I'm sorry if I didn't stay on topic, but
We love the rabbit holes.
okay. As
Yeah, that's great.
long as you're cool with it, that's fine with me. And
Yeah,
I
I think
really
that's.
appreciate the opportunity to talk, and I look forward to staying in contact with you all.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ron. Really appreciate it as well. We love the mycelial network and putting a lot of information out there. It'd be great. We'll maybe have to go in sometime and maybe just, like I say, unpack some of the different little things that maybe people may or may not be familiar with, or people are listening. Google's a great tool. Go ahead and research some of the wonderful things that Ron was saying and kind of figure out a little bit more in terms of some of the history of what's going on and the mythology of the stories and some of the traditions that Ron was speaking about, et cetera, et cetera. So again, thank you, Ron. Really appreciate it. What a great conversation. Thank you, Rachel, for being here. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. We'll see you live again in 2 weeks on Sunday, February 16th. Our next guest is going to be Dennis Walker, who's does micropreneur, does a lot of fun satire as well. So it should be a great conversation. That'll be at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. And until next time, tune in, stay rooted, and let's grow together. Have a great day. Happy Sunday.